Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. We've talked about the downside. We've talked about the ways you can get suspended. What about the ways of staying out of that? What's the best way to minimize the risk of suspension?
Well, if I know I had all the answers, eh?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of things you could do. I think the thing I'd recommend doing first and foremost is actually to have a read of Amazon's policies. It's not very entertaining, and there's quite a lot of them, but people just don't know the stuff that they're meant to be complying with. It's not part of initiation as you sign up to be a seller. And people have been selling for a long time and policies have changed quite a lot over the last sort of 10 years since Amazon was a bit of a baby. And so if you've not made yourself, you know, used to seeing this stuff, especially some of the language, which you'll then see in your performance notifications, you know, it's going to be hard for you to comply with something you don't know about. And I hear this time and time again, people, you know, phone me up, tell me they're suspended. And they're like, oh, yeah, I've not heard of this, or I didn't know I was doing it. I didn't know what the rule was. If you're doing something, you don't know what the rule is, you need to check before you go and do it, because you're just going to, you know, run yourself into some trouble. And I know it sounds like I'm really pushing the rules all the time, but they're not that difficult most of the time to follow, especially if you're not running some crazy, weird business model. And as a result, you're just going to be able to know what to do, know where to draw the line with some of these risks about black hat things. It's going to help a lot. So that'll be my, if you're going to do one thing from this podcast, have a look at some of the policies. You can go in Seller Central, click on the right-hand side, and you can see any policy you fancy, and especially anything that's specific for your category, or if you're using variations, parent-child relationships, look at the policy, understand how it is that you're allowed to do it. If you're doing product bundling, you're putting multiple items together, look at the bundling policy. It seems a bit basic, but it really makes a big difference when you're, you know, going to play these games and do these things. You want to make sure you're staying inside the lines.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like anything else, right? If you're going to go near the lines, you need to be very, very clear about where they are. And I guess one of the things that is intrinsically risky with the idea of gray hat is almost, in a way, a less sensible business policy than the black hat, only in the sense that if you do black hat, you're very clear about what the downside potential is. You don't necessarily know what the percentage. So the downside possibility is you're going to get suspended if you get found out. So I don't know what the percentage chance of getting found out is, but at least you get the benefits of black hat. Whereas with gray hat, you really are dicing with death, but you don't really know how close you are to the line. It's a bit like playing tennis with your eyes a bit blurred shut if you're not sure where the line is. It just strikes me that that's just, if you're going to do that, you might as well be white hat. If you're going to do black hat, you might as well do black hat. And if you get suspended, then, you know, kind of deserve it. But yeah, it totally makes sense to me. So given that there are 100 pages of policy, I'm not expecting you to summarize all the pages of policy, even if you summarize like 10 pages, that would take hours. But could you point us towards the most common pages where you think that people, A, are at the most risk, and B, are the most likely to be ignorant? So you mentioned variations, you mentioned bundling policy. What else is there that we should think about?
There's some broader policies, which I'd suggest taking a look at. Because they are the sort of the fundamental basics on Amazon, and then they build upon them. So there's one called Selling Policies and Seller Code of Conduct. And it's got a lot of stuff that seems pretty basic in it. Let me just read you a few of the bits and pieces, actually, that it says, because they've got some bullet points. And essentially, every other policy is generally actually expanding on these in one way or another. And Amazon are using this as the spirit of the law, if that makes sense. Often, especially with, say, intellectual property, it's about what was intended, not maybe what was actually written. And if you understand what Amazon are intending for their platform and intending for sellers and buyers, then you can interpret what they want to do a bit easier. So they say things like never misrepresent yourself, always act in a manner that ensures a trustworthy experience for Amazon customers. never list products that may cause harm to Amazon customers. Never engage in any misleading, inappropriate, or offensive behavior. It seems all quite obvious, but if you think about all the stuff we've just discussed, actually, the things that sellers could be doing that could get them suspended actually just boils down to some of those points.
Yeah. So never put a product out that could... putting a product out that could harm an Amazon customer is probably not something most people would consciously do. I know one person who I think is consciously doing that. He's a bit of a sort of used car salesman, and you know, he's doing quite well. I mean, you know, it's on his head. It's in my business. But I mean, most of the time, I don't think most people knowingly put stuff out that is going to cause harm. It's just more a question of ignorance and incompetence rather than, you know, willful neglect. But that's still, you know, an offense, isn't it, really? And the other thing to say is, as a basic principle, is that it's a legal principle that ignorance is no defense in the eyes of the law. Now, as we've already said, Amazon doesn't work like a legal system anyway. It shoots first and asks questions answered afterwards to some degree. But I do think that it's not an unfair point that if you can't bother to read their policies as regards your particular product, then I guess you haven't really armed yourself with the necessary proof against them in the first place, right? So it's a fair point. Selling policies and seller code of conduct, you've said about. What are the other sort of main issues that you think people could save themselves from if they read those pages? Which pages would you recommend?
It all's going to vary on how you run your business at the moment and the type of product you're into. I'll highlight a few that are probably important for some people listening. There's a drop shipping policy, something that Amazon added more recently than, you know, the stuff that's been there since the beginning. And if you're a dropshipper, you need to read that stuff because it's literally the rules that you are meant to be complying with. ASIN creation policy is important if you make your own listings, as is then things like product detail page rules and stuff about variations. And there's something about duplicate listings somewhere as well. So all those type of things, if you're making listings, then you need to be learning what you can do, what you can't do, because you don't want all your hard work to go to waste when you've made something.
No, that's true. And I was just reflecting with some embarrassment that having created many, many ASINs and product details pages, I don't think I've actually ever read the policy on that. I mean, I think if there'd been an issue with the client and they'd really had to, you know, come to me with a problem, then I would have said, okay, well, let's look at the rules. But I didn't actually sort of proactively do that up front. So yeah, it's a very good point that, yeah, a lot of us park that.
And I think when you start out selling, it can be quite helpful because Amazon in these rules have tried to factor in every possible way that you could be breaking their policies, everything that every other sellers could conceivably do on their platform. And therefore, if you're new to the platform, you're trying to learn what is it that people do? What can I do when I'm creating a listing? Like, there are a bunch of functionality to creating listings and detail pages that you might not have even uncovered. Functionality you don't currently understand. Actually, by reading the policies, you're going to come into contact with it and understand what it is, what it does, and how it could be used correctly and how it could be misused. And so not only is it, oh, let me make sure I'm not breaking the rules, it's also going to teach you stuff to help you be a better seller and understand, actually, I didn't think about doing things in this way and I'm allowed to. Maybe I can try it like that.
It's an interesting point. I mean, that's kind of knowing, I suppose, the flip side of kind of being very white hat is that you might be playing so far inside the lines that you're giving yourself a competitive disadvantage because you could be doing a lot of things you are allowed to do by Amazon, but that you're not doing out of fear and ignorance rather than sort of fear of the actual thing that's going to cause you harm, right? So it's a good point. I mean, I suppose most people don't think of going to the Amazon seller policy pages as a great education compared to getting a course, at least most people will seem to prefer to buy a course, but it's a very, very good point. I guess there's a lot of education to be had in the detailed pages of these things. So you mentioned drop shipping. Now, obviously, that isn't something that this podcast particularly geared to. There might be the odd person listening, but that brings in the question of business model. And you've mentioned, I know we've had chats about this before, that the business model can quite a big difference to suspension risk. So tell us a bit more about that. How does that interact?
Yeah, so the business model that you choose, that essentially the way that you're going to source your products and deliver them, is going to affect which of these issues you might run into and how likely you are to run into any problems at all. If you are a dropshipper, then you're more likely to encounter some issues than somebody who has their own brand, manufactures their own product, and fulfills them themselves. In that position, you're in control, and so you are able to control the fact that you are complying with all these policies. Whereas when you hand control off to somebody else, whether that's because they are doing the fulfillment through dropshipping or you are sourcing products from someone else using a different brand, you know, going on AliExpress and ordering some items and not rebranding them as your own or using someone else's brand, all those sort of things. You don't have control over every aspect of it. And so then you could potentially run into, you know, some sort of conflict there.
Yeah. So I guess the more supply chain control you have, the better you're going to be able to deal with keeping the quality that Amazon really demands. And as you say, 1% defect rate, we've got to bear that in mind whenever I'm sourcing from China. And for them, the highest quality rate that you can get, AQL3, I think it is the 1% major defect, 2.5% minor defects, that's still going to count for a lot of Amazon sellers as a really major defect in their spoiled lives. And I'm probably one of those people. You know, we get very, very spoiled by Amazon as consumers. And, you know, so to get the match between what consumers in the rest of the world will put up with, what the producers therefore think is really good quality and what Amazon thinks is good quality, is bad enough. And that's without, you know, having somebody very random at the other end, like the drop shipping. Yeah. So I would say drop shipping sounds like a very risky model to use in the Amazon space. I mean, have you had experience with quite a few suspensions of drop shippers in Amazon? Do you get the impression it's highly risky, or is it sort of moderate still?
I'd say it's highly risky. More there's two ways you could do it. You could do it the correct way, the proper way, which would be to get a company that drop ships as their business. They have products they source and you can select to buy them and sell them somewhere else. And you should have a formal written agreement with them. And therefore you have proof that you are, you know, you have sourcing these items and that they're authentic. You're able to prove how you're fulfilling them. The company is bound to a contract to meet Amazon standards. And so you're in a pretty safe position. If you're doing something like online arbitrage, which you could class as drop shipping because the products are being fulfilled by someone else, you don't hold the stock of them, then you don't actually have any of that relationship with that supplier, and you don't have any evidence a lot of the time that the products are authentic. Even though you're buying something from a very large retailer, you have still not got the evidence of a supply chain and evidence that you are allowed to sell that product, or evidence that the item is genuine and authentic.
It's an interesting point, actually. So you don't have evidence of the two crucial things that strike me: being allowed to sell the products and having an authentic product as well. So a lot of this stuff, which I think is, I can understand why people avoid it, because it's very kind of dry as dust and it seems pointless. And most of the time it is, but it comes down to having a documentation of everything you do and having proof of everything you do, that proof that you've got something from somewhere, proof you have the right to sell it, proof that it is what it says it is, that sort of stuff. A lot of the time it's stuff that if troubles don't arise, isn't going to be a problem. But the trouble with that is if you start looking at account suspension in the face because you got slack on some £5 product, that starts to look pretty bad. I mean, is that actually what we're looking at, or is that too extreme? I mean, how much is there a correlation between the amount of offense and the likelihood of getting an actual account suspension?
Yeah, it is as close as you describe. I've got a client at the moment who had an issue with one product, customer complaints about the authenticity of it. Amazon investigated. They're a dropshipper. They struggled to provide the evidence. Amazon added more ASINs to the complaints to request more information. And this is someone with thousands of products, yet only one product initially has kicked them up. And we're at a point now where they're having to get rid of a large amount of their inventory and, you know, find new inventory sources with which to provide sort of evidence of future authenticity. So it becomes a real issue very quickly. And yeah, one product can throw you up.
But technically, they're not actually, it's not really, it's funny because it's like one product that kind of kicks off a deluge of other product complaints. And then what it comes down to is not so much about one product taking down your account as one product pointing up a systemic flaw in your business, which is, in other words, you don't keep any records, or you have maybe no means of keeping any form of authenticity or any agreements or allowances for, you know, being allowed to sell things. So I guess it just comes down to the fact that if you don't have formal agreements and formal processes in your supply chain and in your whole business, sooner or later, it makes you very vulnerable, really. I'm just seeing a more general pattern that's emerging from what you're saying, is just having a lack of documentation and lack of contracts means you're vulnerable, just more generally. Is that an accurate summary?
I think so. And also, you've got to decide what you're building. What is it that you want to happen in your business? Because if you're just looking for a bit of a hobby, you want to click around and play Amazon like it's a game and, you know, work with extremely low margins. And if you're fulfilling in that way, you're going to be, you know, struggle to scale because you're not going to be able to get the supply of the items. Then it's fine because the risk isn't really as bad. If you get suspended, it's just like game over. It's part of the you know, the process. Whereas if you do want to build a large and profitable and successful business, then you need to be, you know, choosing methods that are going to adhere to that, that allow you to get to that scale and allow you to operate in that way. So, you know, it's up to everyone to decide how they do things. I'd recommend doing the latter and, you know, trying to build something, even if you don't want to run a humongous business, you'd rather have a lifestyle business, which is totally fine. Still do it in a sustainable manner and one that doesn't, you know, run into some of these issues.
Absolutely. Let's talk about better quality business models. Now, I think we've established the risks of sort of drop shipping in the sense that you don't have a real agreement with anyone, or retail arbitrage, whereby definition, you're kind of trying to fly under the radar of Tesco's or whoever rather than have an agreement with them. So what sort of business model is safer then? Which in fact is the safest option?
I think that having a private label is probably the safest, assuming that you are doing your homework, like we spoke about earlier, to do with intellectual property law and other policies, because of course if you're selling your product and it's patented by someone else, you're going to run into the same problems. But like I said, it allows you the most control, and that's always a good place to be in these type of things. Also, if you have an agreement with a large company to be the distributor of the item in a particular territory, that's another really good business model, because your supply is really legitimate and you'll have contracts and evidence and all those type of things. A lot of it does come down to just a few sheets of paper with some signatures, surprisingly, because big businesses are used to that. It's been the norm for years and years and years. And so if you're dealing with proper people, that's how they process it. And if you're not, funnily enough, there's no paper trail.
Yeah, it's like a lot of things in life. It seems that having a written agreement, however simple, is absolutely critical. I think it's true with business partnerships. So this is outside the account suspension kind of arena, but it's the same thing, which is that if something's critical to your business, you want to have a written documentation, you want to make sure everyone's agreed on a process, and then you want to make sure you've got some kind of proof of those two things, right? It's kind of basic, but I think, again, it comes down to professionalization. We've talked about this before, so tell me a little bit more about becoming a more professional seller and how that links with suspension, because obviously you've seen over 4 years of suspensions work, you know, getting people reinstated or working to do that. You must have seen a lot of the things that people can do, which after the fact you realize, oh, actually as a professional seller, that's something I need to be doing. So what would you say are your big learnings from that?
I think, you know, you've got to take it seriously, regardless of your current size. You've got to not neglect that Amazon's an important thing. Prioritizing customer service often seems to be something that doesn't happen. And that doesn't just mean the emails you send to customers. It's actually like actually putting the customer first. It's not a very popular way of doing things in business, because it generally means decreased margins, more work, and customers seem to feel wrong a lot of the time to small business owners when we're meant to treat them like they're right. But it's Amazon's mentality and Amazon's way of doing things. And so if we align ourselves with it, we're going to have a much easier time. I think being a more professional seller is all the things you expect when you look at a big company. You expect trustworthiness. You expect them to answer the phone. You expect them to know what they're doing, have paperwork, have lawyers, have accountants. And when you're starting off, it seems quite daunting. But actually, I've made those mistakes and not had those things in the past. And having put things in place where you know you have a system, you know you have contracts and processes, it really removes the ambiguity and a lot of the risk and allows you to make decisions more confidently as a business owner, to know if we do this, this is going to happen. And if this goes wrong, this is how it ends, because of it's dictated in contracts. It's dictated in ways that things happen. And that's the same with staff. If you need some help over Christmas to ship some products, don't just ask your mate to give you a hand. Actually, you need to get some paperwork in place, some contracts, because if things go wrong, it's your business that's going to be completely on the line. If they neglect to send those orders on that week you're on holiday, you know, who's responsible? You don't want to be in this weird and, you know, ambiguous state where your friend covering you for a holiday caused you a suspension, and so now he feels awful because of it. It's your responsibility. It's your business. So you need to be taking these things properly.
Yeah, I think that goes along with everything we've been hearing really from a lot of things. It just comes down to doing the right things. As you say, when you're a really small business, you don't want to add overhead to a crazy degree. But yeah, customer service, and as you said, we often feel the customers are wrong. I think you're absolutely right. We either decide that we align ourselves with Amazon's basic philosophy and everything about what they do, or we're not. But I don't think you have much choice of, if you're on Amazon's platform, try not to be customer centric, then you're really fighting against the tide, as you say. And yeah, having paperwork, lawyers, accountants, you don't have to have spend your life doing up massive, complicated agreements with lawyers, because that can get very expensive. But some things need lawyers, don't they? I mean, you just need to, you know, bite the bullet if something's a valuable part of your business to spend a few hundred quid on a lawyer rather than thousands. I mean, okay, patents are tens of thousands. That's not very viable for smaller businesses, but there are limits to these things. So tell me a bit more. I've heard that there's some new legislation coming on about the way that Amazon communicates about suspensions. Let's talk a bit more about the communication from Amazon, because obviously, famously, Amazon is just, you know, seen by most third-party sellers, and that's certainly my experience, as being pretty terrible at communication at times. But I guess there's two sides of communication out there. There's the sort of creator of the message and there's the receiver of it. What have you seen in the communication from Amazon? Do you think there's any moves afoot to make it clearer? Or do we always have to just go and hire an expert like yourself to kind of read between the lines?
I don't know if they're making anything clearer. To talk about Amazon's communications, almost an oxymoron. The lack of it is very surprising. I don't think you always need to have someone like me to decode it. I don't really decode things. There's no, you know, secret numbers at the bottom of messages that mean anything. It's simply you've seen the same message 100 times and you see what happens next. And so you can predict the future in a way, if that makes any sense. Amazon have a process and steps and standard templates. And so you get used to seeing them in a certain order. And when something jumps out of line, it means something important. And it's going to be difficult for the average seller to be able to spot those type of things. But their emails do tell you what to do, not very helpfully, but it does have the information in there, especially if you go back to the policies and look at what it is they're talking about. They always link them in their notifications normally. They're certainly not getting better at communication. They have started phoning sellers more regularly prior to suspension. There's this sort of more common thing to do with, if it's something to do with your account health or performance suspension, they will send you a notification saying, we're going to call you in 24 hours to discuss this problem. If you miss the call, they'll suspend you. I've never had one of those phone calls because obviously people come to me afterwards. I don't know exactly what happens on them, but you can get the opportunity essentially to explain what's going on, not get suspended, but you still have to do the appeals. So that's a slight change in the process, but it ultimately just leads back to the old system, which is you have to send a bunch of emails and you get back a blank face.
All right. Yeah, it's an interesting point. So it's not so much about reading between the lines, it's they have a process and you've seen the process. So you say after you've seen the process 100 times, you'll know, okay, it's email one in a chain of five and you know where it goes. So what are the basics? If you're writing, I think the word is a plan of action, right? POA. If you're writing, if you get suspended, what are the basics, do's and don'ts in terms of the actions you should take?
Action number one is to go to bed and have dinner and sleep on it. Don't do anything straight away. Amazon occasionally asks for a response in 28, 72 hours. Normally they say 17 days. The 72 hour thing, you do have to respond by then. 17 days thing is a long time and lots of stuff happens between then and now. But you shouldn't do anything to start with. The number one thing is to not panic and write a load of crap, because it's never going to work. You need to work out what you've done wrong, or what Amazon thinks you've done wrong is the first step, because there's no point telling them a bunch of stuff about something they're not concerned about, or even worse, admitting to something which you have done, which they didn't know about. So you need to work out what they think you've done wrong, and then you've got to find out how you're going to fix it. And the best way to think about it is to not try and game the system or say, what does Amazon want to see? There's no amazing keywords that instantly get your account open. It's about good processes, good procedures, and putting in place actual things that are going to stop the complaint, the reason that you've been suspended, what Amazon called the root cause. If you can have a plan of action that stops the root cause from happening again, you know, that issue reoccurring, then you're, you know, going to be able to get your account back. The struggle, and one of the reasons that people hire people like myself, is because they either can't identify the root cause in their business, or it's something they have no idea how they're going to fix because Amazon have made it up and they don't think that's actually an issue, or it's one of those things that's so complex that they're like, well, I would just say I won't do it again, but that's not enough. So those are the sort of steps that I'd suggest taking. It's not impossible to appeal successfully on your own. I'd love to sit here and say, you have to hire me. It's not the truth, but it's pretty challenging if you aren't used to dealing with those type of things, or you're not strong at writing, you're not strong in written English, or if you aren't good at dealing with the pressure and being able to remove the personal element of your account being suspended as well.
I think there's an element of self-awareness there, isn't there, that often entrepreneurs kind of lack. I'm like, I think we're on the one hand, you know, sellers need to be able to look the truth of the numbers in the face, but looking at the truth of their own emotional state can be a bit challenging because we kind of want to feel like we're bulletproof and can do anything we want as entrepreneurs. But the truth is that actually when your own money is being held by Amazon, possibly tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, understandably, your first reaction is going to be a mixture of panic and extreme anger, probably, which is just called being human, right? But as you said, if you're a person that's able to then back off that and be fairly objective about it, then you can handle it yourself. But some people aren't very objective. And actually, that's what makes them strong as entrepreneurs, but it can be a weakness in a situation like this, right? So have you had experience of sellers who've got themselves into hot water through taking sort of headstrong action about this?
Oh, completely. It happens all the time. And people are so passionately involved. And they should be. You know, you can only run a good business if you really care about it. But these things do become our babies. And so when something bad happens or we're accused of something that didn't happen, especially when the system feels like it's against us and we feel a bit oppressed by it, or you've got the pressure of bills you can't pay because of your cash flow issues, or, you know, you're a new seller and, you know, 6 months ago you had no money and now you're making 10 grand a month. And Amazon suddenly hold the cash and, you know, how am I going to pay for my kids' school fees or pay my mortgage or whatever it is? You know, there's nothing quite like that pressure, especially when it came from nowhere and you feel like you didn't do anything wrong. So I hear this all the time. You know, it's a regular thing and it's really quite unpleasant to deal with yourself if you're going to face that and not have anyone supporting you who understands. Business is pretty lonely. So, you know, imagine this is going to go on for a few weeks. Actually, can you just even handle that pressure? If, you know, affect everything, including sort of mental health, if you're dealing with these type of suspensions. So I'm solving the policy issues and writing appeals. And in a way, I'm sort of counseling people through the process at the same time, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, you want to feel that somebody's fighting in your corner and understands your situation and that kind of thing. So absolutely. I mean, I guess you're not in the role of a counselor, but there is something of having somebody to share the burden. But also, I think there is a point where I realized a while ago that I just stopped phoning Amazon seller support because they made me so angry, or rather I chose to get angry in response to their rather poor level of training, understanding of English, and, you know, in my experience, understanding what the hell I was talking about. Now, I probably talk fast and I use long words. I mean, that's probably my bad for not communicating clearer. But, you know, in the end, I made a sort of, if you like, policy decision for me personally that I was not going to phone Seller Central ever. I would send them emails or messages. And then if they wrote back something stupid, it was less kind of infuriating than having a conversation with somebody where I'd ask them a direct question. They just read what was in front of them on a screen on a script and it had nothing to do with that I'd asked, because I personally just find a lack of communication verbally just really kind of offensive. And I don't know why that is. Maybe because I'm a very verbal person. I'm like, you know, that's why I'm interviewing people for a job in the Amazon podcast space anyway. So yeah, you've got to know yourself, right? I mean, I just think sometimes having some buffer between you and that sort of front line can be really psychologically important. And I think also if you have other things that you should be focusing on to deal with the problem, like juggling cash, talking to your suppliers, dealing with your family, if you're having to tighten belts for a few months, or you know, calming down business partners or investors, you know, I think there's plenty that you should be doing, and maybe it's better off giving somebody who's an expert, because they've seen it 100 times before, as you said, the chance to do their job. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I haven't been suspended.
Yeah, and I don't think the size saves you either. Even if you've got a lot of money in the bank, you know, your future suddenly becomes jeopardized. In a way, if you're a smaller seller and maybe you even haven't taken the jump to be full-time and you've got another job on the side, to lose out on something like this isn't that significant of a thing. Actually, your lifestyle can remain the same. You might go back to full-time work. You might go get a different job. Maybe your new Amazon experience will help you get hired by someone else. Whereas actually, if you're taking home high six figures, millions of pounds a year, you know, you're going to have probably built a lifestyle that's going to look like that. And so when suddenly that stops, it's a pretty scary moment to realize, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to maintain all this? What am I going to do in the future? And, you know, the benefit of once you have money, it's easy to make money and you've probably got a bunch of connections now. But actually, it's a pretty weird space to suddenly essentially have closed and ended your business when you didn't plan on doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. So really, it comes down to the more you got at risk in a way, the stronger business person you are, but then the harder it is going to be to handle the pressure of the suspension. So again, you know, if you've got a serious business, I mean, I don't know what your exact charges are, but I mean, if it's going to be, you know, a modest amount of money to hire an expert who can increase the probability of this working and equally buffer you from, you know, losing your stuff and admitting to things you haven't done or just completely losing it with Amazon reps who are badly paid people with a lot of power over your account at that point, I think it's going to be totally worth it. I mean, I'm quite biased in the sense that I'm interviewing, I suppose, but I'm lucky enough I haven't experienced account suspension. If it ever did happen, I'd be, you know, on the phone to you straight away because I know that I would just get emotional about it because I'm just about smart enough to know where I'm dumb. And that's one of the places I know that I would probably get emotional about it. Although I would, you know, try to stay objective. I think it's a bit unrealistic to expect that of yourself. So talking of which, we ought to just talk a little bit about how your service works, because obviously you've given us a lot of very useful information that will help people prevent themselves getting suspended and understand it, which is very useful. And of course, it's something that anyone can deal with themselves if they feel confident. But if they did want to work with you, tell us a little bit more about how you work with people.
Yeah. So like I said, I've been doing this for nearly 5 years, and I was pretty early in the space. And the traditional way of billing and working with clients was you'd wait till you have an issue, and then I'd charge you somewhere from a couple of £100 to maybe a few thousand if for some people to resolve the issue, and you'd pay me. Doesn't matter what happens after that, I'm keeping that cash, and you know, you'd be helped as well as possible. And this is, you know, been what it was for a while, and actually it worked quite well because it weeded out people who weren't taking selling seriously, and it meant that, you know, my customers would be very committed to my work and helping resolve issues. But more recently, the space that I'm in, the industry I'm in, where people write appeal letters for money, become quite messy, and a lot of people are trying to get into it because, like I say, you can make a decent amount of cash for just writing some letters. It doesn't matter if it works or not. And so off the back of that, I've seen this problem of people who have written 7 appeals for their own account, deciding they're going to start this company, and get just, you know, not helping sellers. And, you know, when you know, it's poignant to come off the back of talking about the emotional side of it, because there is an emotional side of it. And actually, for me to operate a business where I took people's money while they're down and didn't help them would be a really difficult and unmoral thing for me to do. And so I've moved to this subscription model because I think it's better for sellers and it's smart business for me as well. So whether you're suspended right now or not, you can come and pay. It's about to be $20 a month per account. And you get unlimited suspension support, unlimited blocked product support. You get access to me to ask me questions if you're going to launch a new product or move into some new business line to make sure you're compliant with policy. And what that does is it totally strips out any risk of me lying to you, selling to you, and providing a bad service, because there's no hiding, if that makes sense. When you get suspended, it is what it is. We've already got this going on. I know your account. I know your business. And I'm incentivized to provide you the best service possible, because then you'll stay subscribed. And if you were to be suspended and you aren't a subscriber of mine, again, you can come along. I've got a calculator to work out if you're eligible for it. And you can, again, join the subscription for, you know, such a fraction of the price compared to going and paying a full fee somewhere else. And that allows you to get an honest upfront service and get the best thing that can be done without any of this sort of pretending and hiding.
That does sound like good value. I mean, if you look at this thing from a very objective point of view, I mean, nobody wants to think about the downsides of any business, and because there is so much invested in it, and you don't want to think about your family's income being suspended suddenly. But the fact is, as you say, that the chances of getting suspended at some point are pretty high, but it doesn't have to be a disaster if you have a plan and you have a person or a, you know, a person and or a plan in place ready to deal with it. So for me, that comes down to, you know, $20 or whatever, it's £15, I guess, isn't it? So what does that equate to? About £150 a year or something like that, just for sort of peace of mind. I think the chances that you're going to use it within a 3-year period, if you're a serious seller, are probably slightly, you know, quite high compared to what you'd want, right? We talked about that at the beginning. We don't have accurate stats about suspension, like everything else in the Amazon space, because they don't communicate. But I know anecdotally, out of, say, 30 serious sellers that I know, about 3 who've had account suspensions within the last 2 years. So that's what, about 10%, very roughly. So if that's a sort of 10% chance of getting suspended once every 3 years, you could do the maths. It's a hell of a lot cheaper than paying people we won't name $5,000 for a template letter, which just strike me as outrageous. I mean, there are some people out there that do offer just outrageous things, and occasionally they get in touch. And as you say, there is a bit of a moral question. How would I feel about handing somebody over? And when I'm going to do affiliate deals with somebody who's going to be a guest on the podcast, I always ask the question, how would I feel about handing my best mates / you know, best clients in the mastermind, who've become pretty good friends in some cases and have been very helpful to me, and I've tried to help them as well outside the mastermind, how would I feel about handing them over? And in some cases, like, if they're going to get charged $5,000 for a template, few weeks emails, I'm like, I don't think I could do that to them. They're not going to look me in the face again. So there is a moral question, as you say. So tell us a little bit more. So if you've got this clever calculator on your site, haven't you? Tell us a bit more about that, because I noticed that the other day. I was having a play with that. A suspension calculator, the strangest calculator ever.
Yeah, so people who are suspended, whether you've got, you know, just got an account suspension, or you have some historic account, for everyone it seems to be Amazon Spain, because they just hate everyone. You know, right, if you want to work out basically what's the chance that I can get my account reinstated with my help. And so using all the data from all the different suspensions that I've dealt with, I've kept records. So I've got a huge amount of information about the people I've worked with and the outcomes of their cases, as well as doing some other independent research so that I could put together essentially a formula. You answer these questions, it assigns each answer a different value, and then it does some maths to work out what the percentage chance you can get reinstated is. So rather than, you know, it's the questions people always ask me when they get in touch is, how long is it going to take? What's your success rate, and how much does it cost? Well, the success rate is such a weird thing, right? Like, your case is different. Every single situation is different. And so it's never going to be representative of my average for your situation. But also, like, a lot of people say, oh, our success rate is 97% or 99%. Well, either they're lying, or they're turning away all the people who they aren't dead certain they can get reinstated. And I never tell anyone that there's a 99% or 100% success rate, because that just isn't a thing. I'm never going to guarantee that I can do something. I've seen people who I was 100% certain would get reinstated internally, although I wouldn't have told them, and it went completely wrong. And it turns out that there's some back-end thing that Amazon knew about, and they've done this and that, you know, 4 years ago. So you can never be certain. And the hope with this calculator is to give people the reality of their situation, tell them an actual percentage. It doesn't shy away from the truth at all. So they can make a decision, right? If it comes back and you've got 12% chance, probably time to go get a job.
Right, yeah.
If it comes back and it's you know, 85%, then sign up for the subscription and you'll be back on the following week, most likely, and you can crack on with selling. And so I'd rather people were informed and sort of set that expectation as well, because it's not very nice for me when people think it's going to work first time after, you know, 1 hour of sending a letter and it doesn't. You know, I don't want disappointed customers. I want them to know the reality of the situation that we're dealing with.
Okay, that's very interesting. And so, you're basically, rather than sort of cherry picking people and not telling anybody about it and then claiming crazy success rate because you only pick the people almost guaranteed to get reinstated, you're kind of sharing that evaluation with the clients, and via your sort of approximate valuation via the quick suspension calculation thing. And I've just used it myself. It's pretty quick to go through. So that's pretty easy. And
I can. It's just popped through now, actually. So you've got 83% as a result.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's interesting, because I was just going through, I was working with a client on account management, and it sounds really bad because I was working with a client and then he got their account suspended. To be fair, they just had hideous amounts of defect rates. And when they told me after a while, like, this one major learning, if you're going to run accounts with somebody, is to make sure that they're honest with you upfront about the defect rate, because it was really hideously high. And I thought, if I'd known this at the start, I would have said to you, do not go on Amazon until you've sorted your product issues out, because you are going to get canned. And sure enough, defect rate was just crazy. Crazy high. And eventually I said to him, look, we should pull these products or you're going to get your account suspended. And then they suspended the listings, I think, and then they just suspended a couple of the accounts, which I'd already flagged out was going to happen, because it didn't take a rocket scientist. I mean, the defect rate was crazy. So yeah, but on the other hand, I think it was a first offense. It was a shortish account. So that, you know, it wasn't something that I thought was going to be a problem to get reinstated. So that wasn't a big, you know, sweaty moment. But actually, no, I think they suspended the listing, sorry, not the account. If I think back, it was quite a while ago now, at least 2 years ago. But the point is that he was cruising for a bruising. And so it was one of those things where it would have been a no-brainer to say, look, it's obvious what the problem is, and it's obvious what you can do about, you know, getting it back on track. So if he had had an actual account suspension rather than listing suspension, I would have said, okay, go talk to Joshua because he'll sort you out. But the fact is, a lot of the time it's kind of obvious, right? It's just when we don't even know what we don't know that we're really in trouble, right? As you said, I think the last thing I'd sort of try and wrap up on, because I'm going to have to head off and talk to a client talking, which is that it's just, as you just said, and you pointed us really to a few very, very essential pages, it's knowing the policies of the platform you're on and being professional. But are there any other sort of final thoughts you've got around, well, before we do that, two things. We're going to ask your final thoughts, final bits of advice to prevent suspension. But for those who do need help, how do people get in touch with you? I should ask that question first.
Yeah, well, please go to my website, suspensionexperts.com, or send me an email, joshua@suspensionexperts.com. Happy to hear from people. And I suppose, well, this isn't what the calculator was intended for. If you suspect you're about to be suspended, or you think you're doing something, you know, and that we've brought up during this conversation, that you think, oh no, am I going to get suspended for that? Is it likely? Actually, maybe log onto my website, use this calculator to find out, if I was to be suspended for this, you know, what are the chances? How risky is this? You know, that may work well in your favor. I'm sorry, you'll end up in a marketing campaign. Feel free to quit it. But, you know, I just want people to not be suspended, to be honest. I'd just be a full-on consultant for other things if people weren't getting suspended. But however much I try and stop doing this type of work, it seems to be that people seek me out. And so, you know, if you think there's something useful that we've had in this conversation, then please get in touch, talk to me, happy to answer any questions and give consultations and things.
Thanks, Joshua. That's great. And it's very good to get a bit of clear-minded guidance from somebody who's been in the market for a long time. And as you said, I really like your subscription model. It's basically like health insurance, right? And it is basically health insurance for your products, for your business, rather, your product-based business, that most of us don't want to ever have to go to hospital. We don't ever want to have an account suspension. We don't want to be in a car accident, but you just kind of pay your insurance policy and then get on with your life. But you have that reassurance knowing that if something bad does happen, that you've got yourself covered. And I think that's a very, very smart and very honest way of doing it, because you're not incentivized to actually want to work with anyone who doesn't need it. And it's just a very smart way of doing things. So a great model. Thank you very much for setting that up, because I think it's an area which needed some cleaning up as an area of services to Amazon sellers. And thanks very much for sharing your wisdom with us as well.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.